House Bill 231, extend the board of parole. I think we only had one issue on that. That was the sunset date. That should be one we should be able to dispense with fairly quickly, but never pre-assume anything. Senate Bill, or House Bill 273, vehicles, transfer and death certificates and estates, and House Bill 77, the disability identification. And for Senator, Representative Thompson, we have the quorum to start business, and I'd like to start first with House Bill 231, extend the board of parole. Ms. Milkey. Get to my right page. Go ahead and identify yourself and for the public's edification, just truncate, just briefly re-describe your bill.
The record, my name
and
is
Esma. We've been joined by Senator Wilikowski. The committee's at full strength. Please.
Esther Milkey, staff to Representative Bob Lynn. The gist of the bill is we are, HB 231 extends the board of parole. Originally it was 6 years. It's been changed several times because of the crime bill coming up. And the Division of Audit found some improvements that they could work on. But other than that, they found them to be in good operating order. So.
Yep. Well, I'm not sure there was a consensus everything. I think we did have some exchanges with the Director Edwards, and I think there still could be improvement on the board, but those will be ongoing discussions. I think even as a private citizen, Senator McGuire will stay interested.
Do you want a motion?
No, we have an amendment. We've had discussion about the sunset date. Conferring with the author of the omnibus crime bill, we're talking about what wanted to be sensitive to having this extension interact with Senate Bill 91 pass, have adequate time to review the parole provisions. And Senator Conkle, you want to discuss what your thoughts were?
Sure. We want to have another audit because we're asking a lot of new duties for both the jail system and the parole board. So I think having a tighter timeline, only because then we get a audit sooner. And so I think this would set an audit in motion probably in 2019, I think, which I think would then come back to us in the year of that sunset. So I think that was the rationale for that. I think if we went to 2020, right?
Okay. Actually, we've incorporated that. I thought there was an amendment. I will withdraw the previous amendment we had on the other version. If there's any objection that offered to that was placed on the table, and I would ask Senator McGuire, you actually had it in front of you. Move the CS.
Sure.
For the committee's consideration.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt working draft N. By Mr. Bruce, dated 4/6/16, for purposes of discussion.
Are there any objections? It's even easier than I thought. Hearing none, that version N, dated 4/16/16, is adopted. I believe we've already had the debate. Are there any other comments or thoughts on this? Any other opinions?
Motion.
Hearing none, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I move the Senate CS for CS for House Bill number 231 out of Senate State Affairs with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, the bill is moved from committee. We'll just take a brief at ease to sign the report. papers back to order. It's 9:12 a.m. We have a couple of amendments before you. I am going to move amendment number one.
I'll object so that we can hear it.
Objection, Mr. George.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Daniel George, staff to Senator Stoltz. Before members, to Senate Bill 150, version A, the initial version, is amendment number one, dated 3/29/16, A.2. This amendment catches an oversight in drafting. This bill was drafted by the administration and added the Military and Veterans Affairs Commissioner to the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. This amendment adds the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to the departments which CDVSA would coordinate services relating to sexual assault, domestic violence for. 1866-050 is an existing statute. The current commissioners on CDVSA, those departments, their activities in this regard are coordinated by CDVSA. With the addition of the Commissioner of Military and Veterans Affairs, that department was not added into this statute, which immediately follows the ones in the existing bill. We ran this amendment by the Military and Veterans Affairs Department, and they concur that it is an appropriate addition to this bill. This was brought to us by the legal drafters and Legislative Legal Services.
Is objection maintained?
No.
Hearing no objection, we're going to go to the public testimony. We'll go to number two, so we'll give that before we get to the. I'll move amendment number two and just hold it so it's part of the discussion of testimony. So
no objection.
We'll invite public testimony because this is really the only substantive change. So we'll allow the folks to comment that may wish to. Where's my iPad?
Mr. Chairman, very briefly, there are two letters in the packet since the last time this bill was heard. One is from the Commissioner of Military and Veterans Affairs. It is posted to BASIS, and the other is from...
dated March 29, 2016.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. And the other one is from the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And I don't know, they may be here to testify as well.
Well, we'll give them... I see folks in the audience, so we'll see.
And Mr. Chairman, just for those who are listening in, this would add who serve as ex officio non-voting members. It would apply to the Military and Veterans Affairs.
And that purpose was so we didn't have to alter the public balance and to keep a fiscal note from occurring on the bill. That's been a sensitivity, and to not to have an outnumbering of government officials over public, but still have a significant presence. So with that... We have folks in the room. I'm going to first invite the Adjutant General Hummel, who is online for questions, and see if there are any comments.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Laurie Hummel, Commissioner of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. I'm just here not to make testimony, Mr. Chairman, but to answer any questions from the committee. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Commissioner General Hummel. Do you, this amendment number two, which makes the commissioner of DMVA or their designee a serving ex officio, a non-voting member, do you support that amendment?
Senator, through the chair, I do not support that. The governor is opposed to making commissioners non-voting members on the administration's own boards, commissions, and councils, and we are opposed to the amendment.
It's on the record. That's what I was hoping on the record, the administration position. So thank you for facilitating that, Senator Wilikowski. Next we have, are there any other questions for the commissioner?
Well, I'll just...
Senator Wilikowski.
Commissioner, the concern has been addressed by the chair as creating a possible imbalance. Do you agree with that concern? Do you feel that's a valid concern? Maybe if you could just address that.
Are you still there, Commissioner? Well, we'll wait in case she was muted or cut off.
Through, through the chair. Yes, I'm sorry, it was so new. Senator, I am concerned about an unbalance, and I feel as though it would be appropriate to add, to enable an additional member of the public to join the board.
But, Commissioner, did the administration propose adding a public board member when introducing this bill, or was there a discussion prior to this amendment?
I do not believe that it was discussed at the time. The potential for imbalance was brought up during public testimony in previous committee meetings.
So the administration in their legislation drafted did not provide additional public members to avoid the a potential imbalance. Okay, thank you.
If I could just clarify something, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilikowski.
And maybe this is a comment for the maker of the amendment, but as I read it, there's four public members right now, and then there's one Commissioner of Public Safety, Commissioner of Health, Commissioner of Education, Attorney General, Commissioner of Corrections. So there already is an imbalance. Are we just concerned? I mean, do we want to? It's already a 5-4 commissioner to public member imbalances. We want to switch it so that we have more public members. We have to add two public members, I guess.
Senator Wilikowski, well, it's not my bill, and but I didn't want to further promote the imbalance, I guess. Certainly the administration could have offered alternatives of replacing this with another commissioner. That's the discussion we usually have is who we're going to replace. Senator.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I think this is a prime example of relooking how we're doing business, and be careful before you ask for something when you're driving up the price tag for the state to do business. So it's not just about adding another one. It's maybe reconstituting how you're doing it, but that's not our task here today.
Are there any other questions? Well, certainly stay online, Commissioner, in case for any final discussion. So you're online.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm online.
Thank you very much. Jane Andreen from the Alaska Public Health Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jane Andreen. I live in Douglas, Alaska, and I'm president of the Alaska Public Health Association and chair of the Alaska Women's Lobby. I also have a 16-year history of working in the domestic violence sexual assault arena. I testified the first time this was up, and I want to say I really appreciate the recognition by the chairman of the need to maintain a balance. I would be concerned about the public members. I think it's important to look at some history. Back in the early 1980s, when the council was established, it was recognized the importance of having the department representatives at a high level coming to the table to help coordinate the effort, balanced out by the experts coming in as public members. And at that time, the balance was established of four department representatives and three public members. I think a good piece of history also for people to be aware of is in, I believe it was 2009, Senator McKinnon had a task force that looked at the council and really dug into how it was established. It was recognized at that time, as has been recognized nationally, that Alaska really serves as a model for that department and public balance. I think that at this point, and in fact, at that time, Senator McKinnon had a Department of Corrections representative added to the council along with an additional public member who specifically is designated as having to come from a rural area. I know that was an issue that came up in the first hearing. I really appreciate the fact that there's recognition of the need to maintain that balance. And if it's a, you know, 5-1, 4-2, 6-1, 5-2, you know, whatever that is, I think that that's okay. I would be a bit concerned that military and veterans affairs be ex officio from the standpoint of not having a voice. It's important that we recognize that those department people bring in the expertise from their area of expertise, so military and veterans affairs. We have been fortunate in the past in this state to have people come in as department representatives who have some background and knowledge of the issues. But their primary role is to serve as that coordinating entity, and I think it's important that they have a voice and be able to speak on that, and that we also add the public member.
Ms. Andreen, each of those commissioners has a pretty strong voice in their department, and frankly, as I look at it, they're the ones the board members have to influence, and when you have a vote in, in a perfect world, maybe they'd all be ex officio members and be there with a participatory, meaningful voice. I sit as an ex officio on one of the major boards, and I don't know that these commissioners of correction and Hess and public safety are really powerless individuals with no other outlet like the citizens. This is an inelegant tool. Maybe they should all be ex officios, but I don't want to tip the cart too much. But this was the most cost effective way to not disrupt the balance and make sure that the public votes were at least at par. So that's where we're at. I know on fiscal notes, it has been a real dance on when trying to make sure we keep our board costs down, because every couple thousand dollars is appropriately scrutinized.
Right.
And that probably would better go to victim services than another member. Right? But that's my opinion. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, just you see the dilemma we're facing.
Mm-hmm.
Board is currently 5-4. This would make it 6-4. There's a reluctance to spend more money on additional public members. Would you rather have a 6-4 balance with the commissioner as a voting commissioner? It seems you're not supportive of a DMVA as being non-voting. Do you think we should bite the bullet and add another public member? I mean, what's your best advice for us?
Through the chair, Representative Wilikowski, I just saw this amendment right before you started discussing the bill, so I would have to think about that a bit. But I think my preference would be, I think it's important that the military and veteran affairs be at the table, and I think that my preference would be then to add on a public member. That would be the ideal.
I remember the position certainly during, there was a time in 2014, especially the fall months, there was a lot of discussion about activities involving organizations involving associated with military and veterans affairs, and I remember some promised activity. It wasn't very temperate. I believe the governor said we are going to arrest, prosecute, convict and incarcerate people, and it sounded like it was going to be a wholesale event, and certainly from the rhetoric of the campaign, and I haven't certainly the combination of the Attorney General's office and the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, it's been a pretty muted response from what I've seen. God forbid it might have been campaign rhetoric, but there were serious problems there, but I haven't seen much after. Maybe there was this demarcation day on November 5th, 2014, and now we sort of have a window dressing issue. I don't know. I'm a little bit troubled that there may be a little political injection in here. Senator McGuire.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. Is there anything in your meetings that prevents commissioners, any commissioner, or frankly any lawmaker that's the chair of any committee from coming and addressing the council?
Through the chair, I need to be clear that I haven't been actively engaged with the council, the sitting council, for 20 years.
Okay.
So I have been working with them in my prior work experience with some of the staff, and now as the chair of both the women's lobby, we're looking at that bigger picture. So I'm coming more from that kind of historical perspective.
Mr. Chairman, is there anyone here, the executive director, or anyone from the council itself, or anyone online? Yes.
Let's see. We have Ms. Morton.
Thanks. If I could direct my question to Lori Morton.
And we'll call you back if you need to. If you care, appreciate your perspective as a. I recognize you from your past involvement.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I can read. Reeves.
Please go ahead, Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Ms. Morton, do you want to put yourself on the record first?
Sure. For the record, my name is Laurie Morton. I'm the Executive Director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Thank you. Through the chair, the question that I had asked is there anything that prohibits a commissioner of any of the subjects, if you will, and or a lawmaker that's the chair of a committee for which there might be some question about domestic violence from approaching your council?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, no ma'am, our meetings are open to the public. We have stated public comment periods of time on our agenda, which would be inappropriate. We also, through our meetings, have issue-specific days, if you will, of the meetings where we would invite guest speakers to come. Certainly somebody could let our office know if they were sexual assault in the military, for example. Then we would make time on our agenda to be able to hear from that representative or discuss that concern. So, no, there's no prohibition against that.
And then just to, if I might, Mr. Chair, through the chair, has there ever been an instance where you've denied a request from a lawmaker, again, chairing a committee where there might be a current issue that pertains to domestic violence or assault, and or a commissioner or a mayor or an assemblyperson? Can you think of a time where that request to address the council has been denied?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, no, not in my position when I was with the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. They actually have a routine standing on the council's agenda item. I've been the director of the council since 2011, and since then, no.
Okay. And so I would just say, Mr. Chairman, on the record, I feel like this is a solution in search of a problem. And just out of principle, I don't support it. And it's not personal to Ms. Hummel. It's not personal to the governor. But, you know, there are issues with domestic violence that are raised all over the state of Alaska. And they're not unique to the military. They're not unique to individual districts. They're not unique. And where do you stop? I mean, I can see a situation where you end up adding different commissioners, different members. You could add four or five more members of the Senate based on the fact that the demographics of their particular district call out for that. And I just don't think it's appropriate, especially in these fiscal times. I think it's politicizing the council, which has been otherwise not political, and that's something I really like about it. It should be focused on the facts and focused on what you're doing, and to the degree that there are individual policymakers or politicians, for that matter, that want to address the council. On the record, it's been stated that they have not been denied that opportunity. They certainly have a chance to address the council, and for that reason, I just don't support it. I think it's a solution in search of a problem.
I'm actually offering this amendment as kind of a placeholder just for the whole concept of the discussion, and I'm going to defer the issue. I'm very comfortable sending this forward to Senator McKinnon in the Finance Committee, who has she's forgotten more about domestic violence in the history than I know.
Well,
that was the purpose of offering.
I could just say,
please,
Mr. Chairman, I'm not comfortable with the amendment either, because it creates an imbalance. And that's the problem that's been elicited here. This is it should be a public board, public dominated board. It should not be a policymaker, commission dominated board by any one administration. And by adding a person, even if they're ex officio, by the time you're a commissioner, that's a big presence. That's an overshadowing presence. And I'm very cognizant of that as a senator. I think it's, when I have served on boards, when I've served on nonprofit boards, I try very hard to offer expertise where I can, but to remain in the back, because there's a power imbalance. And so I'm not comfortable with the fact that we're swaying the balance. And so the only way I'd be comfortable with it is if we were going to add another public member. Now you're at 12, is it? Or I guess we'd have to go to, it's six and five, and we'd have to go to 6 and 6, and I just feel like it's untenable right now. I'd at least ask you to hold it over so we can think about what we want to do.
Very good. Well, we can we'll take the rest of the public testimony, and if there is any, and we'll hold the bill and let the administration come back to us. Senator Wilikowski,
you leave. Just your take on the amendment and the bill as a whole. If you could just reiterate, do you support the bill, and do you believe that we would benefit from having the commissioner of DMVA on the committee? And do you think we need to add a public member if we pass this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, the council is neutral on the bill. We would accept assistance that the administration and legislature thinks would be appropriate to help us move forward with these issues. State members absorb costs within their own department to participate on the council. The council does provide cost for public members. It would be about a $2,500 fiscal note. In these difficult budget times, the governor was very cognizant of that and made a decision to not add the public member. We do currently work with Military and Veteran Affairs and with other facets of the military, particularly in sexual assault response. Members of Fort Wainwright recently attended our sexual assault response team training, for example, in Fairbanks. We've done a sexual assault response team training on J-Bear that also involved the National Guard. We've had the sexual assault response coordinator from the Guard attend council meetings and give presentations to the council. And so I think that the balance is important, and the administration recognizes that. They also recognition the difficulty of adding funds to the budget now.
Thank you, Ms. Morton. I'd like to call up Mr. Christensen, please. You're on behalf of the University of Alaska. At our invitation, we weren't anxious to be up here, go ahead and identify yourself for the record.
Chris Christensen, University of Alaska.
Thank you. Mr. Christensen, is there a problem with sexual violence and sexual assault and domestic violence on our university system?
Mr. Chairman, I think that there are issues with violence on the university campus. Rates tend to be lower than they are out in the general population, but it's something we're very concerned about. We have specific federal rules that we have to follow, Title IX, and it's something we focused on very, very aggressively.
Sexual assault, is there a problem whether revealed or hidden on the campus?
Blindly.
Sexual assault
I think
on campuses.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there is a problem. Some problems are the sort of stranger on stranger violence you find out in the rest of the state, and some of it is I think what is euphemistically called dating violence, but it is between people who know each other. And on university campuses, that I think is the bigger part of the issue.
That's
because alcohol and drugs are an unfortunate significant part of.
If I were to prioritize where the issues were, it wasn't raised in the campaign. It's really concealed. It's because it's not something the university system wants to talk about. If anybody was going to be added, I would want a university person on there. If nothing else, they might get some, not maybe what they'd add, but what they might learn. If I was to add, and I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but it's really tough that we talk about priorities. I think it wouldn't be a window dressing issue. I think that is a problem, and I've spoken about this from the time I was attended one of the campuses here, and it's the undercurrents, and it certainly had a lot of reverberations on Title IX issues on campus. It's certainly not something you put in your recruitment books that you have a high. And I think it's pushed under the rug all too often. If I were to put if I were to prioritize, I would want the university involved with that. If nothing else, that there would be more public awareness, there would be more awareness in how to deal with that. I remember I asked Ms. Morton during another bill if there was a university student that came to her, and said, "I've been assaulted." Where would she refer him? She said anything but she didn't say anything but the two entities she didn't mention were campus security or the administration. It was, that was so telling to me, Mr. Christensen, and I apologize. You were in the room, and I know this wasn't what the bill you came to testify on, but your presence, I think, was important to the discussion, and if we were to prioritize, I'm not speaking for the council, but that is an all too swept under hidden secret, and it's a bad secret of folks that are entrusted. They're in an environment where it's where they don't get the type of help and relief they need because of a culture that doesn't really want to talk about it in that environment. So I appreciate your willingness to come forward. I wanted to put that on the record as part of the discussion. And if we could probably go through and prioritize a couple other departments that might have more relevance to this. Not to undermine the issues that dealing with the National Guard, but I would probably put the university right at the top of the list, and I think other members could add some other folks as well. This is only for discussion, and I appreciate you coming. And you can sulk back there again. But any other comments anybody wants to add, from even if you've spoken before, we certainly welcome them so we know where to start again when we come back. Is there anybody else that wishes to speak? With that, we will hold this bill and have discussions with the administration and I guess the representatives of the stakeholders. The stakeholders really aren't the folks that are going to come forward, but representatives of the stakeholders. And with that, I appreciate the comments by Senator McGuire, and we'll hold this bill. Set it aside. Very brief at ease. Order. It's 9:40. We have before us Senate Bill 171, a administration bill that's picked up a couple of other issues at the request of members of the committee. Mr. Jones, why don't you lay out where we're at, and I will correspond by offering and withdrawing and offering amendments that have been previously before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, Daniel George, staff to Senator Stoltz. Good morning, members. Before members is CS for Senate Bill 171, State Affairs, version hotel. This version was adopted by the committee previously. Just to briefly recap what is in the CS, there is a insertion into the statutes of the state's online checkbook system, and there is a requirement that it include the three components of any fiscal note that a member would see before them: the Department Appropriation and Allocation. This was brought to us at the request of a member from the other body as well. And then, of course, the CS includes components from members of this committee. So that is version H before members. Before going into the amendments, I want to briefly note that there is a revised fiscal note from the Department of Administration dated 4-6-16. This reflects, if the committee adopts, amendment number 3. Previously, there had been a fiscal note from the Department of Administration with some far larger numbers.
Why don't you put those numbers on the record and the previous historic fiscal notes that are relevant?
Yes, so the first fiscal note that came to the committee was a zero fiscal note from the Division of Finance, the Department of Administration. Upon adoption of the CS, because the CS, I neglected to mention the travel portion, the bill also requires, the CS requires the university system and the court system to participate in the state's managed travel program. We heard testimony from the courts and the university previously. There's a letter in the packet from the university system president regarding this. The court system generated a fiscal note and did a very thorough analysis of their travel and determined it would be a cost to the state to participate in this travel system. The university system did not provide a fiscal note, though they did provide that letter to us. The previous fiscal note, I don't have a copy of it here in front of us, but it contains the addition of 3 full-time positions and several hundred thousand dollars of personal services, as well as approximately $81,000 of commodities starting in FY17. That was a fairly significant fiscal note, Mr. Chairman, as you recall the discussion. There was a desire of the Commissioner of Administration to work with the committee. Commissioner Fisher worked with our office and to help find a way to reduce that fiscal impact to the state to implement what the, if I can characterize his remarks briefly, Mr. Chairman, he wanted to work with the committee to implement this policy to make sure that this transparency is available to the public. He said it was a direction that the department wanted to go. So he was willing to work with us, and this revised fiscal note, which we do have staff from the Department of Administration to talk about the revised fiscal note, reflects no personal services costs. It reflects a reduced services cost in FY17 and 18 and does not have any addition of any personnel, so there are no positions added. And, of course, this is contingent upon adoption of Amendment Number 3.
Thanks. I wanted to lay that framework. I am going to, I'm going to withdraw Amendment Number 1. It's going to be replaced by another amendment. Is there any objection? Hearing none, that's withdrawn. And we're going to go to Amendment Number 2 next. And that is removing the court system. Often by putting out that working document, that was really to elicit the responses. It's much easier to get responses to an active bill than a theoretical, and that was the purpose of that. A little more cumbersome, but I think the court system made a case that this would not provide the efficiencies we thought, so that allowed that discussion to go forward. I move Amendment Number 2. Hearing no objection, Amendment Number 2 is adopted. And do folks have Amendment Number 3? We have Amendment Number 3 before us. It's a modified Amendment Number 1. I move Amendment Number 3.
I'd like Mr. No objections. We can hear.
We have objections. Mr. George.
Mr. Chairman, Amendment Number 3, H.5, dated 4-6-16, encompasses the intent of Amendment Number 1, which are the first two portions. It clarifies that the state's managed travel program does not approve someone's travel or reimburse them. It simply deals with the purchasing of that travel. It continues to delay the implementation of the state's online checkbook for 3 additional months to January 1st, 2017. The commissioner characterized this to that it would better incorporate with the state's CAFR, and the timing of that was more appropriate. It also helped to defray the costs. Amendment Number 3 also adds an intent language, or excuse me, a transitional language regarding the timeline of implementation of the state's online checkbook. Software expenditure for transactions by July 1st of 2017 will be implemented. Payroll transactions will be implemented by 2019, and revenue transactions by 2020. There's an analysis of the fiscal note, and Mr. Earhart, I believe, is here from the Division of Finance to talk about how this amendment directly relates to the fiscal note.
Let's go ahead and put that on the record. Mr. Earhart, welcome, sir.
For the record, Scott Earhart, Director of Finance, Department of Administration.
Please proceed.
So as was laid out here, we have been doing our due diligence to strive to make sure that the fiscal note is as small as possible. And so one of the things we did is we went back and looked at elongating the time in order to do the upfront work to implement it and only come back with a fiscal note that has to do with a software platform that improves our performance ratings when we're reviewed by certain groups that rate public internet sites. And so with that, we went back and looked at different avenues and came up with a schedule of doing it in phases with the resources that we have within the division.
In coordination with other upgrades that you're doing at the time?
In coordination with, Mr. Chairman, that is correct, with coordination with other major upgrades we're doing.
Great. Any questions for Mr. Earhart? This is Senator Wilikowski's provision. We'll let him talk about that in closing. Are there any objections to Amendment Number 3?
I'll remove it.
Hearing the objections removed, none other maintained. Amendment Number 3 is adopted. I think you're relieved of your part here, Mr. Earhart. Thank you for being here in the room.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please stay here, but you can get off the hot seat. Next, does everybody have Amendment Number 4 before them? I move Amendment Number 4.
No objection.
Mr. George.
Good morning again, Mr. Chairman. Amendment Number 4, H.6, dated 4-6-16. When the Commissioner of Administration was here previously, he expressed a desire on the record to alter the way that the university is encompassed in this bill as far as their involvement in the state's travel program. The existing language of the CS says that they shall participate in the use the state's managed travel program, so go through the state travel office and all the things that encompasses. And the real cost savings, as expressed by the commissioner, lie in the university systems participate in the state's negotiated contracts. And so this amendment would clarify that the university system use these already negotiated state contracts. They can become a separate entity under these contracts. And I don't know if we have the commissioner online, but that is the intent of this amendment. We have run it by the Department of Administration.
This is at the request of Commissioner Fisher, and it's their bill. And certainly he has a record of demonstrating, trying to find efficiencies and costs. I have a lot of deference to what he needs to do his job. So I appreciate that he has been so involved and are meddling with his bill. Senator Coghill?
Yeah, I'll remove my objection.
Is there any other objection? No? Senator Wilikowski?
I could get on the record. The university supports this provision.
I believe we have a representative.
Would Mr. Christensen care to testify? Maybe it's your one. This one isn't compulsory. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Chris Christensen, University of Alaska. The amendment certainly takes care of part of the problem that the university had. You do have a letter from President Johnson in your file. Very briefly, the university has actually reduced its unrestricted travel budget about 30% over the last 3.5 years. I think no other entity in government has reduced its travel that much. Of course, President Johnson, our new president, is from the private sector. When he came on board, he thought we hadn't done enough. And he appointed a task force with instructions to come up with a new travel system that increased efficiency. And he specifically instructed that they look at the state travel system as one possible option. The first report of this entity is due at the end of April. We're firmly committed to adopting a new travel system. Our preference, Mr. Chairman, would be that the language instruct us to use the state contracts or adopt a travel system that provides equivalent or greater cost savings and efficiencies. It's quite conceivable that we could come up with a system that works better for us. For example, more than half of our travel is actually federally funded travel for the $116 million in research grants we brought in this year, whereas a large part of the state's travel is Medicaid travel, and those are done under very different sets of federal rules. So it's conceivable we could come up with a more efficient system.
So, Senator Mikowski, just do you support the amendment? Do you think there's a better way we could structure some language for you? Or?
Through the chair, Senator Mikowski, I guess I might add language on the end of this amendment. It's saying, so the university shall use state contracts negotiated by the Department of Administration to make arrangements for persons traveling on official business or adopt a travel system that provides equivalent or greater cost savings and efficiencies. That would give us a little more flexibility. It's conceivable we could come up with something better that the Department of Administration
and
might
that,
have looked
that
at.
That may be the case, and I certainly would yield to that. If this has two finance committees to go through, this is in its first committee referral, I think we've laid the issue out, and I don't take a prideful ownership of this, and I think this keeps the discussion on the table, and I would not consider, there's no bad faith if you convince other committees to change this through making the whether it's Senators Kelly and McKinnon or Representative Thompson. I certainly this is the first committee, and we've put our DNA on it. And but from my point of view, I don't have a level of ownership in it. But I think without that in there, the discussion might not continue. So, with that on the record, I hope that alleviates some of the concerns. This is the first of several other committees that we'll have, and I don't have a level of ownership of this other than making sure that the discussion point is there, and if it's in the bill, it will definitely continue, and you will make your cases ahead, and if you convince others, and frankly, I don't distrust that, but we still have time, and you're a man of good faith, and certainly President Johnson is, and I trust that, but this is a placeholder for the discussion, if nothing else. And if it changes, so be it. And a better policy emerges, that'll be what the process yields. And again, this is not anything I'm falling on the sword for. The discussion will continue if the language is in there. And I think we've had a pretty good vetting of the fiscal notes as through the discussion. Are there any other amendments I wish to offer? And on the fiscal note, does anybody want any other further explanation of the fiscal note? Again, through the discussion, I wanted that because it was so integral in the amendments. Senator Coghill, if we make a motion, and then I think if you want to put anything on the record, Senator.
Procedurally, I think there's amendment number 4 on the table, Mr. Chair.
Did I move? I thought the objection was withdrawn.
I removed the objection.
Okay. And just for the record, if the objection was withdrawn, and just for clarity, just for our safety, we'll. The amendment is adopted without objection. So appreciate that, just in case we didn't.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move the CS for Senate Bill number 171, State Affairs, as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
And I'll object. I believe Senator Wilkowski wanted to say something.
Oh, no.
I thought you had.
I think there's been some good work on the bill, Mr. Chairman. I think I'm going to support it. I appreciate the online checkbook additions. I think that's important. Alaska's dead last in the country in our online checkbook, and a severe lack of transparency in what's happening in government. I think this will really help to put us at least get us to the point where people can have a little bit more confidence in what's happening in the government. And the other changes, I think, savings. I appreciate what's been done, Mr. Chair.
The other two finance committees, both House and Senate, will certainly continue to vet these, and I trust the judgment as it goes forward. So I'll remove my objection, and so the bill is moved out of committee with the attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations of the committee. We'll take a brief at ease and let Representative Thompson get ready here. Back to order after a very brief at ease. Welcome, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Chair Stoltz. I'm Steve Thompson, representative from District 2 in Fairbanks. I want to thank the Senate State Affairs Committee for hearing House Bill 77. This bill came about about 3 years ago when several of my constituents who are advocates for the disabled came to my office and asked if I could help them with some legislation. Their concern was that persons with non-apparent disabilities were having bad interactions with law enforcement officers due to miscommunications stemming from their non-apparent disabilities. Our office worked with Wallbusters and Access Alaska to compose a bill that would improve communications on both sides. There's three main components to this bill. Non-apparent disability awareness training for public safety officers. We work with the State Troopers Academy and the police training in Fairbanks and Anchorage. The second part is a short section added to the Department of Motor Vehicles handbook addressing drivers' responsibilities when interacting with law enforcement. This came about when we had about 15 of us sitting around the table and somebody asked the question, what is your responsibility when you're stopped by a police officer? Surprisingly, all 15 weren't completely sure of what their responsibilities were when they were stopped by a police officer. So this being added to the driver's manual will help everybody, not just the non-apparent disability people. And then the third component is a statewide voluntary identification system, a marker on a driver's license, or state ID that police officer or corrections officer or parole officer know that they have a non-apparent disability. This bill can improve communications between all parties and help instruct people on what to expect when stopped by a police officer. And I want to thank the committee for hearing this.
Thank you. This is a discussion my family has had with one of my members of my family has experiences autism, and certainly the interaction can be viewed as strange. Potentially, the non-responsiveness can be viewed by police officers who don't understand these disabilities and can turn badly. We had the conversations around the dinner table over after the Kodiak incident, and which I believe a preventable incident. I appreciate this coming forward, more awareness and training from the law enforcement officials is a big part of this, and the awareness the manifestations of this are so tragic, and every Alaskan has some connection with somebody with a disability in some manner, and I sure appreciate there's a vehicle on this issue. It's more with driving, it appears, but it's a much broader issue than that. But I'm very committed to this. I happen to be wearing the jacket with my gold key on it today, and so it's a totally by coincidence. This was the jacket I didn't spill something on. So. Any other questions for Representative Thompson before he has to leave? I know your staff will stay and
present. Yes, my staff, Lynette Berg, is here to answer any technical questions or additional questions on the bill.
Well, I know you have a lot of pressing things, but I'm sure glad you were here to present the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, very much. And thank you.
Hopefully, I hope there's a will of the committee. I certainly hope to move it out today.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. We will go. Did you care to add anything, Ms. Berg?
For the record, my name is Lynette Berg, staff to Representative Thompson. That's fine. I just wanted to add that this entire bill was an evolution over 3 years, and it had many different manifestations. And we had people from all over the state that were involved in giving pieces of information so that we could make this a good, solid bill that could be accepted by the public and by the law enforcement, and so it evolved into something much different than what we had first imagined because of some of the discussions we had and things that were brought out that we didn't even realize, such as what the Chair Stoltz mentioned about a person with autism, that when an officer approaches them, there's a different interaction than you would have with a person that probably already had been stopped by a police officer and knew that you should get out your license and your registration. So I think this is a wonderful bill, and it's going to help not only the disabled people, but others that aren't aware of what you're supposed to do when you're stopped by a police officer. So I thank you for hearing this bill.
Very good. I think all of our testimony is on remote. You can stay in place just for convenience, Ms. Birch. We're going to go first to Juanita Webb in Fairbanks. I believe if you're off net or in the LIO, Ms. Webb.
Yes, thank you. For the record, my name is Juanita Webb. I am from the Fairbanks area. I'm actually currently studying in the LIO office in Homer right now. I am a member of Wallbusters, and which is a consumer-driven advocacy group that has brought this bill forward along with our partners, Access Alaska and Representative Thompson's office. This bill came about because of need, both on a national level and a local level. The need for law enforcement to understand how a person with a non-apparent disability may have communication or understanding opportunities, and how that can drastically change the interaction with law enforcement, as we've seen in both local and national stories. House Bill 77 accomplishes that through the discrete icon and on ID and driver's license, and education. Education both on law enforcement, correction officers, and probation officers. And this would be accomplished through at the academy level through their training program. Through DMV, there would be education for anyone applying for a driver's license through questions that are added to the test and through information that is added online and in the printed online and in the printed manual. This information will be provided by law enforcement. The discrete marker on the driver's license or ID card is completely voluntary, and as the bill states, that in order to obtain a disability ID, a person has to have proof of diagnosis from a licensed physician, a nurse practitioner, or a licensed psychiatrist. No other proof of disability should be needed. As the bill and affected departments have indicated, meaning the DMV and the law enforcement, there is a zero fiscal note attached to this, and we understand the importance of that in our current budget crisis. Wallbusters understands this is not a get-out-of-jail-free card, that you, if you have done something wrong, you need to pay the price, so to speak. We believe that through education and the discrete indicator, that House Bill 77 will create a safer environment for both general public, people with disabilities, and law enforcement. I want to thank you for your time and your and respectfully request that you pass this through your committee today. And I also would request that someone from the committee request that House Bill 77 to be waived from Finance Committee due to the fact that, as a matter of record of testimony, both the DMV and law enforcement have stated that there is a zero fiscal note. Again, thank you for your time. It's much appreciated.
Thank you. We don't have any Finance Committee's member, but you'll make that pitch elsewhere. So I appreciate your testimony. Next, we have Art DeLon in Fairbanks, off-net. Give a moment for him to unmute. Probably has been monitoring it as he's been on before our committee meeting started. Might have a neck strain. We'll come back to the off-net. We have online, all here for questions. We have Chad Godin from the Alaska State Troopers in Sitka. We have Amy Erickson from Department of Military and Veteran, or excuse me, Department of Motor, Division of Motor Vehicles. And Patrick Reinhart, the Executive Director of the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. I know you're just here for questions, Mr. Reinhart, but we would like to have on record any position of the council or any comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Mr. Reinhart.
Yeah, Patrick Reinhart, Executive Director of the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. And as what was said earlier, we very much support this bill. When the Wallbusters group out of Fairbanks brought it to the council, we recognized very quickly the opportunity to improve the experience that people with unapparent disabilities might have with law enforcement, and greatly appreciate the group's efforts in bringing it forward. We support it wholeheartedly, and we'll do what we can as a council if this is approved to certainly get the word out to the community of people with disabilities across the state. So thank you again for hearing the bill today.
Any questions for Mr. Reinhart? I would like Mr. Godin to provide any comments from at least one segment of law enforcement or statewide troopers division. Mr. Godin, any comments? I assume you've discussed the bill and have had some input. Just anything you can provide on the record?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The department is neutral on this bill. As the academy commander, we can certainly modify our training to meet the requirements of this bill, and as noted previously, there will be no fiscal requirement. We already have an 8-hour segment in our program that covers disabilities, and we have to make sure that whatever we cover is in compliance with this bill.
So, thank you, Lieutenant Godin. Are you... you're neutral from a political standpoint in the department, and the governor's office hasn't taken a position. Do you see value in adding this to your training regime?
I see value. I don't think it's going to solve all of the problems, but I certainly think it is a step in the right direction, and that it's trying to increase communication from both sides, and that can never be a bad thing.
And certainly, I wanted to record certainly the this if another feature of this, if it helps law enforcement better understand the circumstances of both sides, both the person, the public you're interacting with, and the officer's position will be strengthened, I believe. So with that, any questions for Lieutenant Godin? Senator Wilkowski?
I'm not sure who would be best appropriate to answer this question, but if by creating this requirement, are we potentially exposing the state to liability if where the requirements aren't followed, if a person doesn't recognize a person with disabilities, for example?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I'm pondering the question, and I'm not certain that I would be the best person to answer that because I'm not an attorney. Nothing immediately comes to my mind from a law enforcement perspective.
Ms. Burge, has this question come up in the other iterations of discussion?
I don't remember that question coming up, but it is a voluntary designation, and I don't think that you could hold a person responsible if there were certain behaviors and interactions took place. I mean, it's just a notification to law enforcement that a person has a type of a disability, and unless the person self-disclosed what the disability is, that it's really a hold harmless, that they don't know what kind of disability it could
well, I'm
be.
I'm not, I don't want to rely on that.
I mean, that in my opinion, I think that, Chair, that would be...
There certainly is a very specialized area of disability law and similar like that. Senator McGuire.
Well, first of all, I want to say on the record, I like the bill. I think... in my own family, I have a head-injured brother and have had issues like this. As the chair discussed, I think we've all been touched at some point or another by someone with disabilities. I have a few questions on it. I know you want to move the bill along. My biggest area of questioning centers around this issue of liability, and I keep flipping through here trying to see where the various causes of action would come from, but I would like to see if we could get a alleged legal opinion on it, because if to the degree that it creates new causes of action either under disability law theory or under the police council's requirements for training, I would at least like to know, because there might be an opportunity to mitigate or offset what that liability would be with, say, a set mental standard and even perhaps a cap on what the amount would be. So I personally would like to see a legal opinion on it. I do think it exposes the state and, frankly, all of the jurisdictions in which you have correction officers, parole officers, village public safety officers. Not to say that you wouldn't already have a cause of action under a different theory, but this is a whole new set of standards that you're creating. And the other question I have is, that we include all public safety individuals, but then we go on to specify training in the area, and what I'm referring to is on page 3, section 3 then is a little bit more specific to the Department of Public Safety and the training, and we're requiring them to adopt regulations, but I don't see, and I'm wondering if I'm missing it, a commensurate requirement for the Department of Corrections. And I'm wondering why we don't.
Ms. Berg.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the Chair, Senator McGuire, in the version W, there was correctional officers, and in the title it says also correctional officers, they are included. Is that your question? Am I understanding correctly?
Through the Chair, that's correct, and it does mention correctional officers, so that's kind of the umbrella I see as parole officers, probation officers, police officers, village public safety officers. I get that. I see the general curriculum and sort of, you know, requirements in under powers, but then it goes on under section 3 to be more specific to the Commissioner of Public Safety regarding adoption of regulations regarding village public safety officers, etc. And then it says the Commissioner of Corrections may adopt regulations for village public safety officers. I guess I'm just trying to be sure that we're not creating more requirements for those under the Department of Public Safety, the police officers and village public safety officers, that we're not creating more specific requirements for them than we are for correction officers. I guess that what I'm trying to say is I want them equal.
Through the Chair, Senator McGuire, that's a good question, but this is meant to be the standards that apply to all of the officers throughout the state. So it is an equal framework. There's nobody getting different training than others.
This bill has a further referral to the Finance Committee, and the other dynamic is we don't not scheduled to meet again until the 12th for a couple of things. This is a bill that's important to me as well, but I could also adjourn to the call of the Chair if we can get the legal opinions and get those questions answered if we get together for a 15-minute meeting. I would like to, I don't want to slow it down by waiting until Tuesday. I respect any committee member, the two committee members brought up issues. So I will, that's an option where we can leave open a chance to gather together on a ad hoc basis and get it to have a quick meeting after, or whatever the, I'll follow whatever the wishes, or if you're comfortable sending this issue forward with that committee instruction to address these in the finance. If it was going to the Judiciary Committee, I'd have an incredible amount of comfort.
Sure. From this one member, I mean, I'm happy to send it along, but I would just flag it for you. You could limit the contingency fees. You could set a cap. You could define what the offense is with a mental state, a reckless standard at a minimum. There are a few things that you could do to mitigate or to contain the state's liability. I do think you'll have litigation that springs from it. That's just, I do.
Well, that's, I wanted to help the sponsor move on, but when two members bring up a pretty detailed issue, but if, We can flag that issue, and
I would just flag it.
Please provide members of this committee with. We'll request it as well, but I think they answer Senator Representative Thompson's calls a little quicker sometimes.
Yes, so. Thank you, Chair. I will send it.
Mr. Chairman, what I understand you're saying is let's get a legal opinion to these members, but we'll move it along to the next committee so that we can follow our concerns.
Correct. Will Mr. George and Ms. Berg maybe jointly request that so it's coordinated, and then on the record that it's concerns that this committee flagged, and that will certainly the next committee chair will know that we raised that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that should be resolved.
Okay. Or at least we'll have everything on the record. I don't know if we can resolve it, but we'll do it with full knowledge, or more full knowledge. But that was there any other public testimony?
I do have Fairbanks, so I'll back on.
Go ahead, and you can stay in place in case there's any other questions. Who did we have from? All right, whoever is at the Fairbanks LIO, please step forward.
Good morning. My name is Art Delon. I apologize for the problem we had earlier. Mr. Chair and committee members, I am also a member of the Wall Busters, and we became concerned with some of these incidents when people were coming to our grassroots organization and reporting some incidents with police officers that were unfair and they were treated poorly. About, as was said before, about 3 years ago we met with Representative Thompson and his staff and helped to develop a bill to make these encounters safer. And I want to emphasize safety is one of the big overall components of this bill. We want to make it safe for both the police officers and the people with whom they interact. Since that meeting, we've worked with different police academies, especially the Alaska State Troopers, and I want to emphasize that Trooper Gordon was very helpful, and he actually went ahead with some improvements to his disability awareness program that existed a couple years ago and has made quite a few improvements without even the help of this bill, so it's kind of a win-win for all of us, regardless of what happens with the bill. We've worked with the academies, the Alaska Police Standard Council, and other statewide organizations to gather information and support the bill. As far as the training, all three police academies are currently using a version of crisis intervention training. There's no fiscal note to this bill as far as the training goes because they already have a training in place. The training needs to be upgraded slightly, and it needs to be standardized among all the agencies using the training. We would like to make sure that the training addresses the populations of traumatic brain injury, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, autism, and other cognitive disabilities. And as said before, during our discussions, we realized that people in the general public didn't know what to do when stopped by a police officer. That's why we see the section of the bill that addresses training for people through a driver's license, information provided by police the police entities, and also questions on the test. And again, there's no fiscal note to this section of the bill because the updated driver's license manual will be done at the next printing, so there'll be no extra cost to that. The bill includes a voluntary discrete method to identify people. It'll be a very discrete icon on the driver's license, similar to a organ donor icon. But just to make sure that everybody's clear, there's no specific confidential information shared regarding a disability or any other medical conditions. That seems to be a concern with others, but the whole intent of this is to, and this is sort of addressing the question about liability, the whole intent of this bill is to make police officers aware and then give them a tool like the identification on the driver's license to start a discussion with the individual. The icon will tell them that the person has a disability but no other information. At that point, the intent is to, it will open a conversation between the parties and kind of discuss what's going on. Some people with autism and other disabilities have a card that describes what their condition is and how it would be helpful to communicate with them, and at that point that person could pull the card out and show that to the police officer. Again, this bill is all about accommodations, communications. This bill reinforces individual choice and individual rights according with Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And that's important because right now, any public official that discriminates against a person with a disability in any kind of encounter, like a traffic stop or interaction in public, puts the state and any local community in a very libelous situation because they're violating that act. So if we're talking about worries about liability, the state is already in a libelous situation because the police officers aren't trained. And that's what we hope to do is get the police officers trained so we can avoid that liability. And I am not an attorney or any kind of legal person, but I can tell you the intent of the bill is to make the interaction safer. We're not looking at police officers being perfectly able to discern any specific disability with everyone they encountered. We use this as a tool to help them be more aware and it with better communications. We've seen that time after time when barriers are reduced or removed for people with disabilities, it actually helps the entire community, not just the people with disabilities. We appreciate any support you can give to the passage of HB 77, whose goal is to make encounters safer between law enforcement and the public. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Is there any other public testimony? Hearing none, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. I do have a question for Ms. Erickson, the Director of Motor Vehicles. Ms. Erickson, are you online still?
I am, Mr. Chairman. Good morning.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. I just want a little bit of understanding how your division will interact. What will you require from somebody to put that designator? Is it do you need a doctor's letter? Do you need any documentation, as you do for a veteran's designation, a DD-2? In any citizen, how would you, I want to know how you would implement this.
Mr. Chairman, Amy Erickson, Director of DMV, for the record. We envision a simple form that would just have a doctor certify that the person had a condition that was outlined in this bill, and it would simply be the doctor certifying. DMV wouldn't want to know any medical information at all, and we would scan the form into our records and put the designator on the license or ID.
So there is some type of validation. So that's, I think that's good to put that on the record. And you don't envision a fiscal impact. You have the regulatory ability to charge a nominal fee for this. And I imagine there'll be some there'll probably be some fees collected from if folks want to update it, a duplicate license fee, as any other citizen would pay. Is that a correct assumption?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, and to add the designator is $5.
Okay. So you've found a way to, so this is it doesn't provide a cost, but it doesn't provide a barrier as well.
Mr. Chairman, there's no barrier for us.
No, a barrier for the person, not a $5 fee. I
see.
A very minimal barrier.
Yes, it's priced at the same as a veteran's designator.
Very good. Thank you for helping us get that on the record. Any questions for Ms. Erickson? I think we just had our fiscal note discussion, too. Are there any amendments? Senator McGuire, would you like to move this bill?
I would like to move it, and just want to say on the record, just because I'm asking questions or pointing out things doesn't mean I'm not incredibly supportive of it, and I just hope that goes on the record. I think there's probably more cost than what's in the fiscal note, and I'm okay with that as well. I think that there's a cultural shift that we're making in the area of law enforcement. I've discussed it on the record in this committee many times. We're moving away from an automatic assumption that when law enforcement encounters another human being, a citizen of our state, that it's necessarily adversarial, and that it's more an attempt to be a guardian of our public values. And sometimes people cross too far over, and sometimes they have a mental or physical disability that people might perceive that they're crossing over, and they're not. And so I'm very supportive of the bill. I just want to put on the record that I think it could be made a little better in the next committee by clarifying that it doesn't create a new cause of action, a legal cause of action. I think that would be good. Or some kind of clarifying language about what the cause of action would be and what its set amount would be, so the state's exposure is limited. With that, I move CS for Senate Bill number 77 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Thank you, Ms. Burge, and thank you, Representative Thompson, for bringing this forward. The bill's moved from committee with the attached fiscal note and the individual recommendations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate it very much.
I'm going to catch up with an item from on our confirmation hearing. We went over quite a bit, and I think everybody was pretty anxious to. And we're running late for the other meeting, so we have the appointment of Commissioner of Corrections Dean Williams. I'm going to make a motion in accordance with AS 3905080. The State Affairs Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. That's Commissioner of Department of Corrections, Dean Williams. So that we'll pass this around for signature. It's going to end up on the floor anyway, but we just got pretty busy, and I think everybody was anxious to go on their way, and I didn't want to have everybody wait, so that's delayed business. We have just enough time to present the next bill up. We'll do as much as we can get in. appreciate this bill by the State Affairs Committee and its and the provenance of it, Representative Grunberg's involvement. It's one of his legacy bills that we're still working on. Pleased with that, Ms.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. My name is Deneen Tuck, and I'm legislative aide to Representative Bob Lynn. And thank you to the
Senate. I'll just interrupt. That was House Bill 273, just for the record.
Sorry.
Please.
Thank you to the Senate State Affairs members for taking the time to hear this bill today. Representative Lynn was chairing the House State Affairs, and that's why he's not with me. HB 273 is a way that people can explain that can plan their estate without going through the problems, length, and expense of probate. This is the fourth step in this process. A number of years ago, Title 13 provisions were added that would allow a person to have a TOD bank account and designate a beneficiary with one or more beneficiaries, depending on the institution, and simply designated to the account by filling out a small card. When you open up a bank account or thereafter, you can change it or do anything you want, but it has proven to be beneficial. Title 13 provides for brokerage accounts like Merrill Lynch or accounts to do the same thing, and these are also permitted under federal law. It has proven to be a very good step in the area of estate planning and not controversial. You don't have to do it, but you can do it if you wish. Several years ago, legislators carried this one step further in enacting TOD deed legislation that does the same thing with real estate. If you want a TOD deed, then there is a form that you fill out, and it becomes effective upon your death, and you record it. When you die, the person who's the beneficiary simply presents a copy of the death certificate or whatever proof of death that's recorded, and then the deed becomes effective. From what I know, the TOD concept has been very successful, and now we're trying to, with this bill, expand the concept to vehicles. Currently, 15 states have, at last count, excluding Alaska. There's no uniform act yet for this. Hopefully there will be, or a model act, a suggested state legislation or something. But what we did was we got Ledge Research to give us copies of all the state laws, and in addition, copies of the state laws for which four states have expanded this to watercraft, and we also register snow machines in this state. And we're looking at outboard motors as well. The Division of Motor Vehicles has been very helpful and has provided a lot of technical assistance in drafting up this bill because they were given these laws to see how they could put together a bill for us. They did not feel it was appropriate to go with the watercraft, and we can't do aircraft because that is federal and there are others obligations in on their titles. It's not done internally that way. HB 273 is a six-page bill so that it has conforming language with all the other TOD languages in the statute currently. And we worked with probate attorney Beth Chapman on that. Thank you.
I apologize. We're going to have to stop today. I wanted to get the initial presentation, and we will have this back before us at...
Thank you.
I want to welcome also Ms. Epstein as well. Thank you for being here. And with that, any other business to come before us? We'll work with you and make sure we keep this on track.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz, and thank you, members of the chairs.
We were 3-for-5 today. That's
pretty good baseball ratio.
Baseball, but it's not good for other measures. It wouldn't be good for... ratios on hauling, transporting oil or hazardous substances. But as long as you set the bar, that will stand in adjournment.